lecture in a series, the second lecture in a series of four concerning the Minneapolis strikes and the role of the Revolutionary Party as presented by the Young Socialist Summer School. And tonight Farrell is going to speak on, Minneapolis strikes and the Communist Party. Farrell Dobbs.
Comrades, in yesterday's discussion, we arrived at the point where the stage was set for a showdown battle between the Truck Drivers Union, Local 574, and the trucking bosses of Minneapolis. Tonight, I want to begin by examining some of the major aspects of the preparations for that battle, particularly as these things illustrate the decisive role of a class-conscious leadership in union struggles. The Trotskyists, who were the actual leaders of the action, had no illusions about what the union was up against. They were wholly aware from the outset that the bosses were going to refuse to deal with the union and try instead by every possible means to smash the union. They were equally aware that none of the politicians, whether or not they appeared in the guise of friends of labor, could be relied on in any way to aid and support the union as against the bosses, that the situation would be just the opposite. Also, that the general run of the official union leadership throughout the whole town would be scared to death of the action, would crumble under pressure, and would, in the last analysis, be treacherous. They were consequently fully aware that in the last analysis, the outcome of the fight would hinge on the capacity of a class-conscious leadership to mobilize the workers, lead and teach the workers in the course of the action, and undertake to break through all the barriers to the unionization of the truck drivers by the power of the rank and file of that section of the working class involved in the struggle. Let us look first at the consciousness with which the Trotskyists developed their strategy concerning relations with Governor Floyd Olson, then the executive head of the state of Minnesota. Olson was the elected candidate of the Farmer Labor Party as it existed at that time in Minnesota. Today, the Farmer Labor Party has been fused with the Democratic Party and is called the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And it is nothing more nor less than the Minnesota section of the Democratic Party with the name Farmer Labor Party hanging on as an appendage and without any meeting. But at that time, the Farmer Labor Party existed as a separate political entity in the state of Minnesota. It was basically a workers' and farmers' organization enjoying substantial support both in the towns and in the countryside from the working people and the working farmers, although, of course, there were numerous middle-class elements in it. It was a reformist party acting on the political arena in the name of achieving reforms for the workers and farmers under the capitalist system, and it was semi-independent of the two-party system in the sense that within the state of Minnesota, it ran its own candidates, for instance, for governor, as against both the Democrats and Republicans, but nationally, it functioned in a coalition with the Roosevelt New Deal. To a politically conscious person with a class understanding, it was therefore evident that Olson, as a farmer laborite in the governor's chair, was in a peculiar position. And to think this out in advance and know how to proceed because of this was very important to the good and welfare of the strike that was to come. On the positive side, from the point of view of the workers, was the fact that it was politically dangerous for Olson to act openly as a strikebreaker. He couldn't step out, as would a Democratic or Republican governor at that juncture within the state, crass support of the bosses and against the workers. On the other side, it was necessary to recognize in advance that in the showdown that was to come, there would be juncture after juncture in which Olson was sure to maneuver against the union. Now, the contradiction was present, but so long as the union leadership was aware of it and knew how to approach it, it became Olson's contradiction and not the union's contradiction. And from that it followed that the problem of the union leadership was to devise the best possible way to take advantage of Olson's contradiction. Recognizing this in advance and beginning to prepare well in advance of the actual strike, the union leadership opened the gambit by putting Olson on record as sympathetic to the union aims. This was done at an early stage in the spring of 1934, about 6 weeks after the successful coal strike and a month or so before the first general truck driver strike developed in May. You recall I described to you yesterday how the volunteer organizers that had come out of the coal yards and had been victimized by the bosses after the strike was won had been out working both sides of the street all over town, organizing drivers and inside workers, and holding meetings with them in which the workers had a voice in shaping the demands that were going to be presented to the bosses. As this general momentum developed, it became appropriate and necessary and possible to hold a general organization mass meeting. For the purpose, the union rented for a night a downtown theater. and got out a lot of publicity. Now, by the way, here's a little factor that will, in another sense, illustrate the difference between the politically conscious factors that are now in Local 574 and the old line leadership. The organizing committee went before the Union Executive Board and asked for an appropriation to pay a printer to get out a batch of leaflets advertising this organization meeting to summon the workers to this theater. And one of the members of the executive board said, "What do you want money for leaflets for? These guys all know where our headquarters is, and they know we've been here for years, and if they want to come down, they'll come down. Why we got to spend good union money to have a printer tell these guys where we're at?" This was just typical of the mentality we were running up against. Well, we got the appropriation, got the leaflet out, held the meeting. And a formal invitation was extended to Governor Olson to appear at the meeting. And he accepted the invitation, and the leaflet announced that Governor Olson would speak. Now, he didn't turn up. But here you begin to see how the contradiction in Olson operated to the union's benefit, where you had a conscious leadership. Olson couldn't just stay away. So he sent a letter to the meeting. And we had him on record and in even better form than if he had made an oral presentation at the meeting itself. Because it was right there on the official letterhead of the governor of the sovereign state of Minnesota, signed Floyd B. Olson, in which he, in a careful and cautious way, but nevertheless with sufficient positiveness to serve the necessary advantages, gave approbation and approval to what the workers were asking, what they were striving to do. Now, as I say, the conscious leadership was wholly aware that this couldn't be taken at face value. But it helped in various ways from time to time as the going got rough in the battles that were to come, and particularly when Olson would begin to maneuver and wiggle around and do some pretty desperately drastic things in an effort to get out of the contradiction he was caught in. That was one aspect of the preparation. Now let's look at it from another point of view. What concretely did it mean when we say that the union leadership was wholly conscious from the outset this was going to be a showdown fight with no holds barred? How was this reflected in the other aspects of the preparation for the battle? First, let me make the generalization that everything about the physical preparations for the strike were calculated to demonstrate to the bosses, to the workers, to the politicians, to all the union bureaucrats around town, that the union meant business. We began the truck driver strike, their mobile strikes. We began by renting a huge garage. It was about a block long and probably as wide as two-thirds the distance from here to there, this building, equipped so that the picket cars could drive in and out, which was necessary for a series of reasons. Within the headquarters, a commissary was established where the strikers could be fed on a mass basis. Before the strike began, thinking in terms of the probability of a siege, relief committees were organized within the Union to go out and chisel groceries from friendly merchants, go and explain the facts of life to landlords that had to depend on the working class for their rent when they got too tough with the striker about his rent, and to see that strikers who deserved help got it, and at the same time to safeguard the Union against chiselers and freeloaders. And these relief committees came right out of the ranks of the Union. In addition to the facilities for the mobilization and dispatching of the pickets, the commissary and the relief committees, we erected a hospital in the strike headquarters and secured the services of 2 doctors and 3 trained nurses who, on a virtually volunteer basis, functioned on full-time in the headquarters once the action got underway and the hospital began to be used. Now, we had another situation that is of particular interest. We found, as the action got underway, that the cops had our telephone lines tapped. They had police spies around in one and another way, shape, and form. And when we first began to dispatch pickets, receive calls from a picket detachment in trouble with the cops out someplace, or to dispatch pickets to some place where we found that an outfit was trying to operate that shouldn't, we learned that the cops would be there ahead of us. It didn't take as long for that. They had, by the device of tapping our phone and other means, this inside information. So there was a particular contingent of volunteers that turned up in the strike that we organized into a courier service. They were the counterpart in 1934 of the young men and women you see all dressed up in the garb for the occasion that ride motorcycles. The equivalent of the PACs that were dramatized in that picture that Marlon Brando played, and I forget the name of the picture. The Wild Ones. These were the Wild Ones of 1934. They turned to, and we had the most magnificent kind of a courier service. In addition